The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
the beast.
We're told in the Book of Revelation.
This is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan!
Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will oppose you.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
Where we've been serving humanity for over a century. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. And you mean you and I?
Together, yes.
Over a century?
Combined.
Oh, that's true. In fact, because, of course, this is toward the end of October, it's that time of year, we should indeed have scary music because my birthday is today.
Ooh,
scary stuff. I'm a sexagenarian.
Hi. I'm trying to think of a family friendly
answer. How can I answer that if children are in the room?
Yes.
Well,
that just means
I'm 60.
Yeah.
And I'll be a sexagenarian for the next 9 years till I turn 70, when I'll be a septuagenarian.
At which point I will be a sexagenarian.
Yes.
So
right now you're a quintagenarian.
That's right.
So Sam is in dog years. He says I'm older than anybody. So
yeah, so just yeah.
I'm old. Watch out for me.
He's down under his binky down there, just kind of grunting and grumbling away.
He's so very happy.
He had a good walk this afternoon. It was productive. The temperatures here in the east central Illinois are upper 40s today.
So are we central or southern? What are we?
Technically, we're considered east central Illinois by the National Weather Service, and I'll consider them the controlling legal authority.
So southern, does that begin below I-70 or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, it depends on who you ask. I think the good rule of thumb for determining the line between southern and northern Illinois is when you stop seeing the pump jacks out in the fields pumping oil out of the ground, and you start seeing those big windmills.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably a good way to figure it out. But
yeah.
I say do it Chicago and not Chicago.
Which one?
Which is how most people in Illinois
the state would prefer
it.
Yeah.
That is so true.
Yeah. We saw a great sign photoshopped and posted to the web here not long ago that said, "Welcome to Illinois." Sorry about that Obama thing.
We're 6 days out. I think it's six.
Really?
Nine.
9 days out.
9 days out.
Because it's a week from this coming Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah. The day we get to vote. And
speaking of scary music.
Yeah. I really should have had some
either
wrapped
way,
up
I
and
think
cued and ready to go here. All I've got are, well, I've got, for some reason, I've got my quartet singing Kentucky Babe on here, but that's
here's
not
the
really
great
that
thing.
Scary.
Here's the great thing. In post,
every
time I say the word scary music can play.
That's true.
And it could be something by ABBA, if you choose. Or it could be actual, Halloween music.
From my perspective, scary is the Christmas cantata we're working on right now because the tenors have to sing A flat.
Exactly. Ooh. Scary and in
so
stratosphere.
That is scary.
Yeah, it's very difficult music.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult.
So, well, the election coming up 10 days out, I guess is we can touch on that just a little bit.
It's been beaten to death. It's going to be the way it is.
Right.
I think you and I have, well, frankly, I think the only sober way of looking at it as Christians,
mm-hmm.
it's going to turn out the way God wants it to turn out, no matter what we do.
And that's scriptural. And as tough mm-hmm. as it is sometimes to swallow that perhaps Barack Obama was the man God allowed into the office, scripture says that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
It
doesn't mean that I have to like what his policies are.
No.
Because it may be that God placed him there, frankly, to do some harm to the United States. In other words, to put us under pressure
mm-hmm.
to drive us on our knees.
Yeah. Very similar to what happened to the ancient Hebrews over and over again.
Mm-hmm. They didn't like it when those Syrians would come down over
and over. The Syrians
and
the Ammonites and the
all those Ites.
All the Ites. They had a lot of Ite problems. but it would drive them back to God. And after some period of repentance and sackcloth and ashes and prayer, God would answer, deliver them, and they'd be thankful for a while. Then a generation would go by. They'd get fat and happy. And, oh, yeah, we did that. It was our swords that won the victory.
Yeah, but the problem is that, assuming that the pollsters are correct, mm-hmm. then, honestly, Americans aren't being driven to prayer.
No, it seems to be going the other way.
Yeah.
But for the first time in America's history, the number of people who self-identify as Protestants is less than 50%. And the number of people, the percentage of Americans who don't self-identify with any particular church is, about a third now?
Yeah, that's what's really disturbing.
Yeah.
Because honestly, self-identifying with a church doesn't mean that you practice Christianity.
No. We've talked about the polls done by George Barna many times at within the last 10 years have shown that even among evangelicals, people who self-identify as evangelicals, fewer than 10% actually have a biblical worldview. They may call themselves evangelical Christians, but they don't literally believe that Jesus was born of a virgin, lived a sinless life, was literally resurrected on the third day, literally walked on water, you know, that sort of thing.
So why would you call yourself an evangelical Christian? I mean, literally, call yourself a Christian if you didn't believe the very tenets that
of Christianity.
Defined Christianity. I mean, if you don't, then is it because, it's a great job? I like being called a Christian. I like I like hanging out at that church because they're really cool. Love the music.
Great coffee, good programs for kids. And for some, it's frankly, it's a way to make social contacts.
Like masonry.
Or business contacts. Sure, like masonry. Like you know,
do we have secret handshakes?
The Rotary or Kiwanis or whatever else. I don't know.
That's crazy.
Well,
I know. You're probably right.
Oh, sure, sure.
That's really sad.
No doubt. But, you know, we know of situations personally where people have said we need to increase church membership because the church needs to regain its stature in the community when it was influential in local politics and business.
Yeah.
That's not the right reason to attend church. That's not the right reason to identify with any particular religion, but sadly, it is a reason that some people do.
Well, you know, that being said, that's one of the reasons, frankly, for years and years, you and I really didn't attend any given denomination or any given building, where people met. We didn't go to that congregation over and over again as regular attenders, much less as, you know, members on the rolls. We finally found a place where we feel like we belong.
Yep.
If the Lord moves us to a different town, I honestly don't know what we'll do when we get there. Because the truth is that, yes, we belong to a wonderful body of believers in the flesh and blood right here in Charleston, but we also are members of an incredible body of believers, not just worldwide, but people that we communicate with every day. People that we, you know, only know, let's say virtually, if you want to put it that way. But the truth is, virtual is bits and bytes.
Mm-hmm.
Our relationship with the people on the internet is much more than that because the Holy Spirit connects us in a way that is beyond description.
And that's really true. I started to laugh as you were saying that, though, as you said that not just worldwide. And I thought, but what, intergalactically? Or?
Yes.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go off in a weird direction.
No, and that is where
there.
I thought about going, but then I saw the look in your eyes.
That was wise.
When I look in your eyes. yeah. If you've ever seen Dr. Doolittle, then you know that song was sung to
a seal.
A seal.
Yeah.
Not a Navy SEAL, though. Actually, I'm reading a book about Navy SEALs right now.
SEAL Team 6.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No easy day.
This was the fellow who wrote the book and then was...
He was.
Came under all sorts of attack for his critical remarks about the president in that book.
Well, I haven't gotten to critical remarks about the president yet. Mm-hmm. It must come in the very last part of the book. I'm about two-thirds of the way through. And just now it's getting into the real nuts and bolts of the mission itself.
Based on the criticism of the book that I heard when it was released, I thought that this book was almost an anti-Obama campaign release.
Not so far.
Release. Well,
No, not so far. Hmm. The only thing that really has struck me in a negative way, honestly, is really not against the president it's against the bureaucracy in sure. place when a soldier on the ground wants to do a mission mm-hmm. and is required, much like policemen on the ground, policemen and women on the ground, that a soldier on the ground is now required to fill out paperwork constantly.
Yeah.
You take out so many insurgents in an area, and you have to make sure that you document everything you did there through digital photos. That's why I was telling you he was taking a digital camera with him. That was standard. It wasn't just the bin Laden mission. They had to take pictures of all their kills to prove that they really had a gun, to prove that they were really, that it wasn't a child or a woman. They had to take as much information from the actual site as possible to prove to the local the local religious authority, the local police authority, anyone who might complain to NATO.
This was done for legal liability.
Legal liability. Oh, about 2/3 of their time seemed to be spent, you know, making sure that they weren't legally liable for mm-hmm. something. And in fact, he goes in the foreword to the book, he discusses how he had to spend a lot of time, and my understanding is this may have been ghostwritten, so it was at least him and possibly another writer, and lawyers, lots of lawyers, mm-hmm. making sure that they didn't do things that would in any way compromise the security of other SEAL teams out there, you know, reveal tactics that weren't publicly known, things like that. So the book itself is a nice look into what it's like to be part of what he actually calls, I think it's called DevGru. It's not, they don't call themselves SEAL Team 6.
The war for which SEAL Team 6 and their colleagues in Army, Marine Corps, Air Force will be deployed apparently is going to continue indefinitely. Greg Miller, a reporter for the Washington Post, this weekend, last week, would have been published on Wednesday, the 24th of October. And I kind of tracked this through the column written by Glenn Greenwald, who used to write at Salon.com. He now writes for The Guardian, which was what referred to as the communist paper of record by somebody I heard the other day. But I like Glenn Greenwald because even though he is a progressive, he's an honest progressive, and he has been writing for several years now, almost since the early days of the Obama administration, that this administration that ran on a platform of ending the wars, closing Gitmo, turning back the intrusions into America, the lives of American, the American public that were initiated under the Bush administration. For example, he specifically during the campaign, then candidate Obama said would work to eliminate the immunity granted to the major telecoms for their collaboration with the National Security Agency in spying on American citizens, because some whistleblowers had come forward. They said there's a room in San Francisco, for example, where the NSA essentially has tapped into AT&T's trunk lines. It's a massive an operation that they called it a country tap, not just a wiretap, a country tap. The lawsuit against the NSA was tossed out of court because the judge ruled that the person who filed the suit with the help, I believe, of the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, EFF, didn't have standing to file the suit because it wasn't that there were so many people who were affected by this that no one person
A class action suit?
It would probably require a class action suit, at which point they'd probably find some other reason to toss it out of court. But the whole point was that once he became president, Obama's Justice Department did a 180 and is now defending the immunity of the telecoms, Sprint, Verizon, AT&T, against lawsuits from people like you and me who don't want our phone calls listened on without a warrant. I mean, the constitutional protections guaranteed us in is it the Fourth Amendment or Fifth Amendment? Fourth.
Fourth,
where,
I think.
Where the government is required to have a warrant specifying why they want to look through your stuff and what specifically they hope to find before they begin looking through your stuff, whether it's your physical stuff, like searching your house or apartment, or your email or phone calls, your electronic stuff, those are basically gone out the window. There is no more constitutional protection there.
Just really quickly, so we know where we are, the text of the amendment is, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. When you're doing a country tap,
yeah,
it's really impossible unless you say all the people of the United States are the persons involved, and the place to be searched is the entire United States, and the persons or things to be seized, that's the entire United States and all of their worldly goods.
Essentially, yeah. Yeah. It stands the United States as we thought we knew it on its head. We fought a war against Great Britain in the 18th century to get rid of these unlawful searches and seizures, which is why that was put into the Fourth Amendment, the Bill of Rights. And this, the last two administrations, presidential administrations, have essentially argued that they don't apply during the global war on terror. And according to Greenwald and his summary of the article written by Greg Miller of the Washington Post, and I'll put links to both of these articles in the show notes, the administration is planning to continue the global war on terror for the foreseeable future, for at least another decade, which according to Miller means we've only reached about the halfway point of the war on terror. I mean, okay, we got Saddam, we got Osama bin Laden, we got Anwar al-Awlaki. Oh, wait, but there's still so many more out there. So we just can't let up now. We've got to add to the kill list. In fact, the headline of the Washington Post article is "Plan for Hunting Terrorists Signals U.S. Intends to Keep Adding Names to Kill Lists." Now, the question that seems obvious to me is, if you're adding names to your kill list, are you actually doing any good? I mean, if you're killing these guys and yet you're having to add more names, what's the point? Why are we doing this? And the fact is that there are American citizens on these lists, as we've known from the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son.
Exactly, his son as well.
Who was also an American citizen. What's really disturbing, and we kind of always knew this because we didn't hear the Republican Party screaming bloody murder about the overreach of a Democratic president who was defending and asserting his right to assassinate American citizens that he deemed a national security threat without any congressional or judicial oversight. There's a video posted at Washington's blog, and I don't know the name of the author there, but it was posted just a few days ago. In fact, actually today, the video was created by a group called WeAreChange.org, a young man interviewing Republican Congressman Peter King, who is the chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security. And he asks Congressman King that what seems like a very good question to me. I'm surprised we haven't heard this from, Wolf Blitzer, Anderson Cooper, any one of the Fox News reporters. Representative King, if Mitt Romney is elected president, he will inherit Barack Obama's kill list.
Yes.
What's he going to do with it? And Congressman King's response was, get him out of here, get him out of here. And this guy presses the issue a little bit, and the guy essentially calls him, quote, a horrible moron.
Who is asking the questions?
A young man who represents a group called WeAreChange.org. Now, I don't know anything about WeAreChange.org or what their politics are. I mean, it sounds like a progressive organization.
It does, doesn't it?
But this is a question that the Republicans should have been asking Barack Obama. What gives you the constitutional authority to order the assassination of American citizens? Because they weren't asking the question, we suspected that we would hear an answer like the one Peter King gave to the young man from WeAreChange.org, which is, yes, this is right, this is constitutional, and if you question it, you're a horrible moron. We could probably play the audio from this. It's about 2 minutes, but since it's coming off of YouTube, it may skip and stop during their playback. But I'll put a link to that also in case you want to look that up and see it for yourself. Peter King is one of those go-to guys who shows up on Fox News on a regular basis. He gives good interview, always comes across as tough on terrorism, tough on Homeland Security. He's obviously a good and gifted politician. I don't mean good in the sense of morally good. He's good at being a politician. But we kind of suspected this would be the answer. Republicans haven't complained about the presidential overreach, the constitutional overreach. I'm trying to think of another word. I can't think of anything
better. Honey, you haven't had anything to eat since lunch.
Yeah, well, that's I'll blame that. the reason Republicans haven't complained is because they just want to get their hands on that list, so they get to add the names. The White House counterterrorism advisor John Brennan has been working, and this is getting back now to the article written by Greg Miller of The Washington Post, is seeking to codify the administration's approach to generating capture/kill lists. And we know the capture is just there for show.
Yeah.
Part of a broader effort to guide future administrations through the counterterrorism processes that Obama has embraced. All of this, Miller writes, demonstrates the extent to which Obama has institutionalized the highly classified practice of targeted killing, transforming ad hoc elements into a counterterrorism infrastructure capable of sustaining a seemingly permanent war. No kidding. So you've got the CIA, CIA Director David Petraeus, pushing for an expansion of the agency's fleet of armed drones, which is really a shift of the CIA from being an intelligence gathering operation into a paramilitary force. And when you think about it, the CIA was tasked with going out, sending out spies, collecting information and bringing it back to the White House.
Yes,
so the president could be briefed and make intelligent, informed decisions about American foreign and military policy. But with a fleet of armed Predator and Reaper drones, the CIA now has its own military force, basically. And
of course, if someone hacks those drones.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that in just a second.
Sorry to derail you there.
Well, no, but that's okay, because we're about a third of the way into the program.
I apologize for letting you take the reins for so long. I'm still trying to figure out if we are changes George Soros or not.
There's an interesting euphemism that is now being employed in Washington, D.C. Regarding this process of developing these expanded capture and kill lists. They call it the disposition matrix. According to Miller's article, over the last 2 years, the Obama administration has been secretly developing a new blueprint for pursuing terrorists, a next-generation targeting list called the Disposition Matrix. The matrix contains the names of terrorism suspects arrayed against an accounting of the resources being marshaled to track them down, including sealed indictments and clandestine operations. U.S. officials said the database is designed to go beyond existing kill lists, mapping plans for the disposition of suspects beyond the reach of American drones, end quote. Disposition apparently meaning how are we going to dispose of them. This will be overseen by the National Counterterrorism Center, and the purpose is to augment the overlapping kill lists maintained by the CIA on the one hand and the military, the Pentagon, on the other hand. In other words, they're trying to set up a central clearinghouse to determine who's going to kill or who's going to be killed without due process of law. Miller, the Washington Post reporter, describes it as a single continually evolving database, which includes biographies, locations, known associates, and affiliated organizations, as well as strategies for taking targets down, including extradition requests, capture operations, and drone patrols. And this analytical system that determines people's disposition, in other words, how they're going to be disposed of, will undoubtedly be kept completely secret. According to the article, motivated by President Obama's refusal to arrest or detain terrorist suspects. So rather than go to the trouble of arrest or detain them, because, you know, you get this Gitmo problem already, you know, what to do with the arrested and detained suspects there. So the easier solution is to just drone them. Or as Gilbert O'Sullivan once sang, a drone again, naturally. No, not original to me. That's credit to Adam Curry of the No Agenda podcast. So that's worth reading. It's a much longer article. It goes into some depth. Glenn Greenwald, again, almost a lone voice on the left, who's saying, hey, you progressives who argued that George W. Bush was the second coming of Adolf Hitler. The president that you elected, the Peace Prize presidents that you that you elected, is has gone much farther.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they are
and here's the
silent
thing.
About
Romney
this.
May well go even further.
He may. He may. As we've discussed before, it's our theory that you go back over the last few presidential administrations, and there seems to be this sort of left-right pendulum swing since the first Reagan, or since Reagan and the first Bush administrations. Then you swung to the left with Clinton, who was able to get through some reform on welfare that would not have happened under a conservative president or a Republican president. I hesitate to use the word conservative because Democrats would have just opposed anything. But because it was a Democratic president, suddenly we got welfare reform.
Mm-hmm.
And then with swings back to the right, you get George W. Bush, and he passes the Medicaid entitlement, the drug entitlement, and an expansion of the Department of Education under No Child Left Behind, the greatest expansion of of discretionary
entitlement.
Yeah, discretionary non-military spending since the FDR administration would never have happened had we had, say, an Al Gore presidency, because Republicans, conservatives would have just been all up in arms. But suddenly we got a Republican president. Let's pass all this entitlement stuff. This isn't socialism. This is fine. But then you start to get the blowback from the ongoing war on terror and the intrusion of of American civil liberties, and so we elect an allegedly progressive president who has taken what Bush and Cheney did and taken it so much farther, and the progressives are all good with it. In fact, there was an article, and I'll have to dig this up. I don't have it in front of me, but I read that there was an interview this week with a progressive columnist who was asked about the morality of blowing up suspected terrorists and their children in places like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, and places like that. And this guy apparently actually answered the question by saying, "Yeah, but you know, hey, whose 4-year-olds are we blowing up anyway?" As though it's okay. It's okay to blow up a 4-year-old as long because we know the 4-year-old's going to grow up to be a terrorist anyway.
A little brown 4-year-old somewhere doesn't really matter because...
Yeah, because it's probably a terrorist that we blew up. So, you know, because he's from his...
And he's going to grow up to be a terrorist anyways. Oh, my goodness.
Let's see if I can find that here so I can attribute this.
That is so wrong.
Yeah, okay, this was on MSNBC on Morning Joe. And it was... Joe Scarborough interviewing Joe Klein of Time Magazine. And let's see, Scarborough offered as a conservative or a nominal conservative anyway, he's a little more critical apparently of these drone attacks than a lot of others. He said, you know, if you're between 17 and 30 within a half a mile of a suspect, we can blow you up. Klein interjects to argue that drones are decimating bad guys, and Scarborough responds that the attacks are taking out a lot of innocent people as well. Klein marvels at the notion that drones provide the advantage of not needing pilots anymore. The killing can be done via a joystick from California, which causes Scarborough to respond, quote, you have 4-year-old girls being blown to bits because we have a policy that says, you know what, instead of trying to go in, take the risk, get the terrorists out of hiding, we're just going to blow up everyone around them. Scarborough went on to declare, listen, I hate to sound like a Code Pink guy here. I'm telling you, this is causing this collateral damage that seems so clean with a joystick from California. This is going to cause the U.S. problems in the future, end quote. And by the way, wasn't Ron Paul considered a loony for saying it, just this very thing? That a lot of the blowback from the Middle East is being caused because they don't like that they're being blown up by American drones,
yes,
including a lot of innocent people?
Yes.
Well, Klein responds to this remark by saying, look, the bottom line is, in the end, whose 4-year-old gets killed? What we're doing is limiting the possibility that 4-year-olds here are going to, 4-year-olds here is going to get killed by indiscriminate acts of terror, end quote. So it's okay to kill 4-year-olds over there if it saves 4-year-olds over here. That is reprehensible, regardless of what political color you wear.
Exactly. And you mean red or blue?
Red or blue, yeah.
Or you
pink.
Know, if you were on the radio.
Yeah.
Right. Now they say, oh, no, no, it's hate speech.
Yeah.
She used the C word.
So, yeah, Joe Klein of Time Magazine.
By the way, you wouldn't be able to talk about this story at all if you were still on the radio.
No. It's kind of funny because I talked like this when we were on Columbia and
I
was accused of sounding like somebody from NPR.
Yeah, I know. But the truth is that you have never been afraid of attacking either side, anybody who is doing something that really is just not right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what really opened my eyes during the Bush administration. I mean, the Clinton administration, my eyes were open when I was like, oh, wait, he really was lying about that dress. This isn't just a vast right-wing conspiracy after all. But during the Bush years, when the drug entitlement passed, and I heard Sean Hannity defending it, it's like, wait a minute. He was going after Bill Clinton for exactly the same thing. We're living in 1984. We've always been at war with Oceania.
With Oceania. Yeah. Yeah. 9/11 Truth is apparently some loose 9/11 Truth movement group. According to the Book of Knowledge, that they're behind We Are Change.
Okay. All right.
I don't know. I've also found references to it's possibly a group of hackers. I don't know. I really don't know who is behind this. But ultimately, there are a lot of organizations out there, including Responsibility to Protect, .org, that very wealthy man that Glenn Beck loves to go after, George Soros, he admits that he, in fact, in 2010, he admitted that he essentially purchased Human Rights Watch.
Yeah. And then Human Rights Watch, the work of Human Rights Watch
is often cited
by
Responsibility to Protect, exactly. Yeah, which, if that's a familiar phrase, was used by President Obama to legitimize our intervention in Egypt.
And Libya.
Yeah.
That's a phrase that's been around for a while. Go back and look up the interview with Carl Tykrib on View from the Bunker. You can vftb.net and do a search for Carl Tykrib, and you'll come up with the interview pretty quickly. He did a program on Responsibility to Protect and what it means. And essentially what it means and what it will lead to is a one-world government with a one-world police force or army that asserts the right to go into any nation at any time because we have a responsibility to protect citizens from their own governments.
It is allowing the UN essentially to run the world.
Right.
At least that's what the UN thinks at
this point.
That's
the goal.
That is the goal,
right,
according to the UN.
Right.
However, it really does achieve a goal that George Soros has had since he was a boy. Mm-hmm. He claims that from the time his earliest memories, he has longed to unite the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his way of uniting the world. You know, the funny thing is, I was saying this to you the other day. Can you name, and maybe I'm wrong, so listeners, tell me if I'm wrong, is there a country in the Western Hemisphere, I mean, literally mm-hmm. the Western Hemisphere, the North American continent, the South American continent,
mm-hmm.
that George Soros has opened offices, is starting one of his color activities, or do these things tend to take place over in Europe and the Middle East?
He's even
got one going on in Burma now.
That's a good question. Now, George Soros is from where? He is from Eastern Europe.
Yes, he is. I'll tell you here in a second.
And
I'll
that may
go
have
to
something
the
to do
Book
with,
of Knowledge.
Yeah.
Well, it's the way he was brought up.
Oh, Hungary.
Hungary.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He was brought up Hungary. So he's just starving.
But he
had no money,
mm-hmm.
and he essentially figured out a way to use other people's money and
currency trading, yeah.
Yep. In fact, he brags about practically taking down the Bank of England.
Mm-hmm. Which is a little wobbly right now anyway. By the way, I saw that Mervyn King, who's, what is his title? Governor of the Bank of England?
Exchequer? Governor? I don't know.
I'll look it up here. He essentially said that within the last week or so that we need
economist
to quit.
And
governor. Yeah,
governor
that's right.
Of the Bank
governor
of England.
Governor of the Bank of England. Said that we essentially need to quit pretending that these banks that are wobbling over there just need to quit pretending that they can actually pay back their debts.
Well, now, I saw a story day before yesterday, at a site that I didn't post this at PID News because I couldn't verify that the site was legit, but it sure looked legit. The story was that the Bank of Germany, the Bundesbank, is out of gold. that they've been out of gold for a while, and that many of the banks no longer have their gold reserves that really are linchpinning themselves in case everything hits the fan. The gold reserves are a big deal, which brings me to another story that I saw a couple of days ago, that more tungsten-filled gold bars have been discovered.
Oh.
They seem to be turning up all over the place, and it really makes me wonder, are any of these gold bars really any good? And if they're not, what little fairy has been going in and switching, you know, the little changeling gold bars? Here, I'll take your real gold bar. It's really heavy. Now, mine's really heavy too, but, you know, you'll like this one better.
You've been practicing a little alchemy. At Mac, they've been turning tungsten into gold. It's a miracle!
Speaking in tungsten. Sorry, I just had to say it. I'm sure someone else out there had already said it. So.
Sure, sure. Good one. Good one.
Thanks.
So there are things out there that economically on the horizon are not looking good. Mervyn King was kind of scanning through this article here, and the article in the Telegraph doesn't quite put it the way you kind of have to read between the lines, but essentially what he's saying is that banks need to raise capital, which means they don't have enough money to pay off their debts.
Wait a minute. Isn't that what happened with the housing bubble?
Yes.
They were upside down in their debts.
So until we quit propping them up, and I guess, you know, Halloween week, it's appropriate to talk about zombies. Until we quit propping up these zombie banks, things that are dead but are pretending to be alive, we are not going to recover. We're going to have to let the crash happen. There are also more stories popping up here this weekend about the so-called fiscal cliff that the United States is heading toward at the end of the year, which is the automatic change in the federal budget that was a product of the budget deal last year. And of course they appointed that, what did they call it? That 11 member committee, or they appointed a congressional super committee or something.
Oh, the wasn't super it Congress. 16 it was, member? Let me look that up.
And we were talking about this because we couldn't find any justification in the Constitution
for this.
They
didn't do anything.
And they didn't reach a deal was the whole, you know, so it'd be kind of became a moot point, but it set an ugly precedent, I think, where they created a...
Consult the Book of Knowledge.
Yes, a super Congress of just a few people to try to come together on a budget compromise that would avoid some of these things that are going to kick in because of sunset laws. So on January 1st, there will be a combination of lower spending and higher taxes that, according to some economists, will suck about $600 billion out of the economy.
You are correct, by the way.
Super Congress.
12 members.
12 members.
Six
right.
from the House, six from the Senate.
Right. Again, we find no justification in Congress or in the Constitution that allowed Congress to do this and say, look, we can't reach a decision here. We got 100 guys over here. We got 435 people over here. 530. We just can't come to a decision. Let's just appoint 12 people. Let them do all the hard work. We're going.
Look, here's the truth. You know, it's really expensive to have all the states run these individual elections.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the super committee was so successful, we thought we would just take this right to the streets and we'll just meet over here at Joe's and we'll decide, yes, Joe Biden's house, and we'll decide who wins the election.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yeah. It'd just be much, much quicker, Joe's. Faster, a lot more efficient.
And
by the way, look over there. America's Got Talents on TV. Oh, great.
I love that
Football.
Show.
Oh, Survivor. Yeah. So,
Honey Boo Boo.
Yeah, Honey Boo Boo.
Still haven't seen it. Don't want to.
But the Learning Channel, which, you know, it's no longer the Learning Channel because there is no learning that takes place there. TLC has actually has a new show coming out called My Giant Face Tumor.
Oh.
Cable television has become the freak show.
Yeah.
The carnival freak show of the 21st century.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're not that far away from it becoming the Colosseum
and the
gladiator games of the 21st century. That's probably just another decade or two away.
Well, the Hunger Games was very popular. book mm-hmm. and movie.
Yep.
And that's essentially what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Quat loose for everybody.
So anyway.
You ever think about that quat loose? They're not a physical currency because these are brains in jars.
Star Trek reference. So you folks at home
so
can
play. So it's all theoretical. They're keeping track in their brains.
Yeah, that's what money has become.
So it is really like a supercomputer.
A simulation.
Yes.
Now watch
which
it.
Which is like the short story that you love so much.
Yeah, I have no mouth and I must scream. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, watch it. You're getting awfully close to talking about, the holographic universe. That all that.
Well, I know. Yeah, that's just timey-wimey. Yeah.
Wibbly-wobbly.
We watched, by the way, Deja Vu. And I do not know which one of you out there, one of my friends on Facebook, recommended to me that Deja Vu would be a great movie. I really apologize that because it's been a while. Mm-hmm. I put that on our list a long time ago. We finally watched it. It's really good.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good and I'm not surprised because when you start looking into some of the names behind the film, you can see, okay, yeah, I can see why the script was really good. One of the writers of the script was half of the team that's written the Pirates of the Caribbean scripts and a number of others. But, those have always, for the most part anyway, have just been, good plots and very snappy dialogue, very clever. And this was a very inventive, creative script, good dialogue, interesting characters. The director, Tony Scott, is Ridley Scott's brother. He was the one who recently committed suicide. Yeah. But Tony Scott did a number of other really well-made films, well-directed films. So it's very stylish. And Denzel Washington, Val Kilmer, you get two excellent top-of-the-game actors right there. So well worth watching. And Jim Caviezel.
Oh, yes.
Jim Caviezel.
He's really good.
Who's in another great time and space continuity type film called Frequency with Dennis Quaid. That one is really good.
That's the one where it's the dad and the son.
The dad and the son.
That's right.
And they play with a little home two-way radio.
Yes.
And somehow through some freak of physics, they realize that they're talking to each other across 25 years in time.
Right.
Yeah. And I won't go into any more than that because it's a really tense plot with an ending, you stand up and cheer at the end. It's great.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, this one
Frequency
is like that, too. It has, we won't go into more than that, but yeah. Frequency and Deja Vu. Not Deja Vu.
Which was one of the characters in Top
Which
Secret.
Which is a Val Kilmer movie.
Yeah,
so.
Top Secret, yeah. Deja Vu. This is Chocolate. Chocolate Mousse. Oh yeah, Deja, played by the actor Jim Carter, who's now the the butler on Downton Abbey.
That's right. Well,
Deja Vu. Do I know you from somewhere? Just really clever stuff. Peter Cushing was in that film too.
He was. What an incredible
great,
actor.
Yeah,
so much. But back to news. There was an earthquake last night.
Yeah, I didn't see where it was. I saw an email come through. It was really late at night, and I had to be headed for bed.
Off the coast of British Columbia. It was a 7.7, and they had a 6.3 mag aftershock today. There was a tsunami warning, but it was only a couple of feet high, so they called it off, which is really good because, what is that? The Marianas Trench? No, not the Marianas Trench. What is that area called? That subduction zone off the west coast of the United States.
I'd have to look that up. Subduction zone, west coast. Cascadia.
Thank you.
The Cascadia subduction zone. Risk of giant quake off American west goes up. What?
No.
Is that a link from the...
And in the meantime,
yep,
on the northeast coast...
Yeah. Sandy is causing all kinds of trouble.
And this is not your sister.
No, I asked Sandy to stay back in South Carolina, but she never listened to me when we were little anyway, so I didn't expect her to stop. What they're saying, being serious now, is that this is looking like the first storm of the century. There will probably be others as we go forward, but this bears some similarities to the 1991 perfect storm, the one about which the film with George Clooney was made. Radar from Washington, D.C., as we're recording this on the afternoon of Sunday, October 28th, showing that the storm is just off the coast, D.C., Baltimore, Virginia, New Jersey to the north. Winds already at 40 to 50 miles an hour with gusts up to 70, hitting the eastern shore of Maryland, the land of my ancestors. And they are expecting anywhere from, well, in those areas like Delaware, again, the Maryland eastern shore area, 5 to 10 inches of rain. And
it's a good thing that isn't moves snow.
Further. It's going to move further inland, and as it gets further inland and toward some of the mountainous areas of New York and Pennsylvania, it probably will. They're saying possibly up to 2 feet of snow. So, yeah, some really high winds, lots and lots of precipitation. Could really be bad. New York City is planning. What did I read there? They're shutting down the. Shutting down the subways in New York?
I read that Mayor Bloomberg was contemplating the forced evacuation of almost 400,000 people.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think shutting down the subways would be a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like it's going to make...
You don't want to be down there if it floods.
Looks like it's going to make landfall at hurricane force in southern New Jersey, South Jersey, and basically smack right into Philadelphia. This is based on the five-day forecast cone from the National Hurricane Center at the National Weather Service. And that will probably happen sometime late Monday, early Tuesday. So the 29th, 30th, showing the probable path of the storm. But it is going to maintain, according to this forecast, tropical storm force winds quite a ways inland, almost as far inland as as Lake Ontario.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Now, the storm that it's meeting up with.
Coming from, which came through here, Illinois, in the Midwest. It was a long frontal boundary that stretched all the way from Lake Superior down to Texas.
And it's still migrating across the United States?
I'm going to have to.
Because if it came through here a day or two ago, is it staying overnight in Indianapolis?
It could be. Yeah,
it's a great town.
Visited the Creation Museum in Cincinnati, possibly.
Might be. Stopping off to see Rust Izjar in northern Ohio.
Yeah,
I've always wanted to meet him.
Yeah. Now I'm trying to find a radar link here. But anyway, the whole point of the storm is that you've got a hurricane that essentially is meeting up with another storm system that has tracked across the United States over the last few days. And it will... combined to join forces. You don't often find, I don't know that in my lifetime, and I'd have to look to be sure, but I don't remember anything of hurricane strength hitting the east coast of the United States. I mean, further north than North Carolina.
No.
It's very rare.
One that almost was earlier this year? Wasn't there one that was predicted to hit the northeast and then at the last minute? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't recall.
Was, you know, just little bitty waves that sort of, they were a few feet high.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is going to get a lot of attention in the media. And here in the Midwest, that's one of the things we kind of watch, because anything that affects Washington and New York, that access Washington, New York, gets a lot of attention. Now, granted, there are an awful lot of people who live there.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of really nasty winter storms and summer storms that track across the Midwest, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, with rare exceptions. I mean, I think the storm that hit Joplin, Missouri last year got a lot of media
coverage.
Was
that last year or the year before? Anyway, recently.
Yeah. And the storms that went across Alabama and hit Tuscaloosa, the Birmingham area, that did seem to get a lot of attention. Joplin especially, because the destruction there was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It even tracked over as far as Branson when I was there this summer. They still had areas this summer, and it was from last year, that had been damaged and still had not been completely repaired. Remember the grocery store that was kind of around behind the back way next to the Walmart there? Yeah, they had that fenced off, and there were steel supports that were bracing the exterior walls against the parking lot to hold the exterior walls up.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah.
Well, since you have brought that up before we go too long, I want to make sure that everybody remembers there is a great Future Congress 2 meeting in Dallas, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It is not this month. It is actually going to be January, just after the Christmas holiday, January 4th through the 6th of 2013. And the reason that David Hitt, who is organizing all of this, the reason that he tells us that he chose a date in 2013 was to get away from the 2012 hype.
Right.
Essentially,
right.
We're still here. Now what do we do?
Yeah, we don't want 2012 predictions to be part of the future Congress. So that's why it's being scheduled for the first week of 2013.
Which I think is a great idea, because the truth is, I think we're all still going to be here.
Yep.
And it's never been assumed by Christians that no matter what happens on December 21st of 2012 of this year, that that we'll be gone. I really don't think that. I think that we'll all still be here, and we need to figure out how we are going to reach a lost world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with love and the truth through 2013 and beyond. Because honestly, a lot of people, particularly New Agers, unless something major happens that is allowed to happen by God, New Agers are going to be looking around, well, what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did the Christians, did you hold us back?
You know, I hadn't even thought about that, but that's...
Oh, I remember back in the 1960s when I was first reading about the 2012 phenomenon in the 70s. They were the New Age doctrine at that time was that we would be entering a portal, a time window, that essentially everybody would be upgraded unless there were too many non-believers, essentially the born-again Christians. And if there were too many of them on the planet, they would hold us back. And so there was a theory back then that the Christians would be taken away to a special, you know, remediation center. Yeah,
re-education?
Yeah, re-education
Oakley center. Oakley doakley. Relax and let the hooks do their work.
So January 4th through the 6th, 2013, Future Congress 2 in Dallas, Texas, and it is futurecongress.org?
Com. Futurecongress.com.
Go there, and you can register, or if you can't be there, we're going to try our very best. And by we, I mean all the people involved, to make sure that there are DVDs. There may even be some streaming content that you can find available that will either be free or very, very low priced.
Mm-hmm.
Derek and I are still determining whether or not we're going to go. We have been encouraged to attend, and we'd love to be part of it. We're still waiting for the Lord to say, yes, I want you there. Doggone it, I want you there.
Because there'll be a lot of folks there that we would really like to meet. In fact, one is a guest on View from the Bunker this week. That's Dr. Judd Burton.
Yes, you chatted with him yesterday.
Yeah, and that'll be posted shortly. By the time you hear this, it will already be online. It'll already be too late.
It's deja vu.
So we will. We had a good discussion about the beliefs of early church fathers, second, third century church fathers, about the Nephilim. You know, what did they believe? What were they teaching? And interestingly, he mentioned that Papias, who was remembered by Irenaeus as it's like when our little automated phone voice, you know, announced that our cable company was calling yesterday, phone call from Mediacom. Irenaeus wrote that Papias was a hearer of John, meaning John the Apostle.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about somebody who learned from somebody who learned directly
from
our Lord. And Papias was of the belief that the Nephilim were literal. They had literally walked the earth. There were giants on the earth in those days and after that, you know, et cetera.
Well, that's
so
really
that's,
important.
That's the discussion. And
I want to bring this up really quickly. I put this to the PID Radio Cafe, and I will put this on our show. I thought of this question the other day. Why didn't the Nephilim build boats?
That's a really good question. Why didn't they build boats?
Everybody
big,
has a different
guys.
Opinion. Big, strong. They could have easily, you know, build us boats,
mm-hmm.
or we'll eat you, you know.
Well, sure. That yeah, they could
they
have done
built
that too.
Them themselves, slave labor.
Yeah.
Slave labor to get it, you know. So why?
I'm going with the God hardened their hearts.
That was one of the opinions, and I think it's a really good answer.
Yeah. I'll take God harden their hearts for 100.
All right.
So, that's the best answer I have. But clearly we know that they didn't, because they perished.
Isn't it funny? I'd never, ever thought of that question until the other day.
Sure.
They're just going to stand there and let the water, you know.
Well, and this was an interesting approach that Brian Godawa took in his novel Noah Primeval and Enoch Primordial, which was the follow-up. But in Noah Primeval, it becomes clear that Noah contributed to the building of the boat, but he didn't do it all, that it was actually started by Methuselah. And that the boat was built essentially in secret, in kind of a hidden valley, away from the prying eyes of the Nephilim.
You know, that's really interesting, because I've always pictured it the other way, that he was preaching about it the whole time.
Right.
And they're
right.
all laughing at him. And I think that's how we traditionally think of it.
Yes.
Godawa
right.
really has some out-of-the-box approaches mm-hmm. to topics that we discuss every day.
Well, when you ask that question, I stopped my thought about it and said, well, yeah, I mean, we knew that Noah was preaching it. Wait a minute, do I really know this? Let me go back and look this up. And when you look for the mentions of Noah in the Bible, you don't see that Noah was actually preaching during that time at all.
No.
I mean, he's referred to as a preacher of righteousness in the New Testament. And forgive me, I've forgotten where the reference is now.
Hebrews?
Could be. But that is only in one translation. In another translation, he's referred to as a herald of righteousness. So the word is translated differently in the ESV than it is in other translations.
It's in 2 Peter.
2 Peter,
and spared not the old world, but saved Noah,
right.
the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. Let's see what...
Or a herald of righteousness.
Yeah, I was going to say, let me see what the word translated preacher really is.
But either way, the text doesn't say that Noah was preaching while he was building the ark. He may have been a preacher of righteousness after the flood.
Or even before. Maybe before.
It doesn't say anywhere in Scripture that Noah was preaching.
It is the word charax, and it means a herald or messenger vested with public authority who conveyed the official messages of kings, magistrates, princes, military commanders, or who gave a public summons or demand and performed various other duties. Herald or proclaimer of the divine word. So, either way. Ambassador.
So, yeah. But I think that my assumption, I think yours as well, was probably shaped somewhere in our past, either by Sunday school lessons
or
by a Cecil B. DeMille movie or something, because I was under the assumption, too, that Noah was out there teaching and was being laughed at by all his neighbors. But what if, as in the Godawa book, what if that wasn't it at all, that the Nephilim didn't know that it was coming on them? And that was the whole point of what Jesus is talking about in the New Testament when he says, as it was in the days of Noah, when destruction overtook them suddenly and they were totally unprepared.
Yeah, and they may be not just humans.
Exactly, because in Luke, he makes reference to not just the days of Noah, but the days of Lot, which would refer to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Did those people, I mean, was Lot warning them? No, Lot didn't have time to warn them. The angel said, get out now. Don't even take time to turn around and look back because the sulfur is about to fall. So it could be that... Noah wasn't warning. The Nephilim didn't build the boats because they didn't know that they needed the boats. That's possible, too.
The boats.
Interesting to speculate. Not.
I know. You can't. We'll know one day. I've got a long list. Lord, here's my list.
Want to follow, just finish with one thing here. You showed me a video that was kind of interesting. It made the news in Mexico recently. That cylindrical thing falling into the volcano.
Well, you know, I've seen a few people that have responded to that. One is a friend of mine from Life Unlimited, in fact, a very smart guy. A few people saying that it's just an artifact.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is this is a camera that is always focused on that volcano, that this either belonged to the news station or belonged to a reputable source that the news station believed, that they wouldn't have... You know, okay, well, if some guy off the street that you never met before, hey, look what I got.
Mm-hmm.
It's this great big cylinder falling into the, that volcano there. Right there. What I find interesting about this volcano is that it's supposedly, the myth arc of the volcano in that area is that it was a warrior who was turned into a volcano. And he died because he wasn't able to have the woman that he loved.
That's and Sam at the 59 minute and 15 second mark. He's spot
he
on.
He is so good.
Time's up.
That this young man stabbed him, this is the name of the volcano, stabbed himself in the heart.
Hmm.
And so interesting that we've got this cylindrical thing coming down and essentially stabbing the volcano in the heart of the volcano. I don't know. It probably is an artifact. But what made me really curious is that there's another video that I think I also linked to in my comments to my post on Facebook that shows a similar object over Pike County, Kentucky.
Hmm.
A cylindrical object.
Mm-hmm. Just hovering.
Just hovering. So I don't know. I don't know what's out there. Artifacts. Clearly, we're in. I am.
Well,
I
you know that thing in the volcano, that could just have been a meteorite falling from the sky, for all we know.
And an artifact that it just came straight down.
Yeah.
Meteorites, you generally come down at an angle. They don't
well,
come down
that's
straight.
True.
And they're usually not cylindrical.
Well.
And that could have been an artifact. I know that.
Right.
It could have been.
It moving at a speed.
It just looked very, very strange. Yeah. Don't know what's going on. It's always Mexico. It's always Mexico.
Yeah, I know. They just pay a little more attention to that sort of thing.
Maybe
perhaps,
they do.
Maybe they're just more prone.
Maybe they just believe in the supernatural more down there than we do.
Creates an atmosphere for it, if you will.
I don't know.
Possible. Anyway.
I think we're out of time. Sam has already left the room.
He's put down his paw. And that means time to roll.
The dog equivalent of Elvis has left the room.
Have a wonderful week. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content, copyright Gilbert House, and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear.